Good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Thursday, June the 29th, 2017, 1:13 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, and we are almost into the month of July, only one more day left in the month of June. Do want to let you know, Marion Midget Football is celebrating 45 years of football and cheerleading. Registration is at Lincoln Park from 5:30 to 7 p.m. tonight, June the 29th. It's tackle football and cheerleading. Ages 8 to 12 years old, a $30 fee, one-time $30 fee, and a birth certificate are required. King and Queen signups are a $10 fee for all ages. If you want more information, contact 740-382-4558 or 740-751-2948. And remember, the Popcorn Bowl kicks off the midget football season. It is the first Sunday after the Popcorn Festival, the first Sunday after Labor Day, and we play at Baker Field, where the old Baker School used to be, off of Route 95 here in Marion. And we want to congratulate our treasurer, Patty Worcester, and Martha Douse Manasi, both celebrating 35 years with Marion Midget Football, which is celebrating 45 years in the Marion community. O.J. McDuffie, who went on to the NFL, was a graduate of Marion Midget Football. What a program. So don't forget that, June 29th, tonight, 5:30 to 7 p.m. at Lincoln Park, $30, and a birth certificate, ages 8 to 12 years old, to play. We have a great hour coming up here. We're supposed to be joined momentarily by DNC Vice Chairman Michael Blake to talk about health care, which we did not get a chance to do yesterday. And also at 1:30 to be joined via telephone by longtime journalist and journalism professor here in Ohio, Emil Dansker, coming up at 1:30 today, which, again, a lot of fun. I think we have one of our calls coming in here. Again, you're tuned into WWGH Radio 107.1 FM. And unless you've been living under a rock, healthcare has been on television, has been on radio, has been in the Senate, in the Congress. What's going to happen? Do the Republicans have enough votes to pass it? They do control the Senate, but they can only lose two votes. What's going to happen? Well, helping us all sort that out today is the DNC Vice Chair, Michael Blake. I'm sure you've seen him on CNN and a multitude of other places. Mr. Blake, thank you so much for joining us today.
Great to be with you, Scott. How are you doing today?
Doing very well. Let's get right into this. When do you think the vote's going to happen? Mitch McConnell has postponed it until when?
None of us know. They say they're going to postpone it until after recess. I think we all need to be prepared that this would be the Monday after their 4th of July holiday, so we could be looking at the 10th. But let's be clear, Scott, the reason why they're postponing, Republicans and senators came forward and said they can't vote for it, because tens of millions of Americans are saying they cannot vote for this bill. It would take away health care for 22 million people. And so while we wait to see what they're doing, this would hurt too many people, and that's the reason why we can't move forward at all.
We had a gentleman call in yesterday when I said that figure, that 22 million people would lose health care, and he said, but we're going to save, it was $12 million or $12 billion, and 20-something million people have already opted out of Obamacare. What is fact and what is fiction there?
So let's be clear to set the record straight on that point. The savings means you're cutting funding for a program. The reason why there have been fewer insurers in the states is because the states didn't expand Medicaid. Medicaid is the program that provide more support for low-income communities, communities in poor communities, communities, residents living in rural communities, et cetera. So if you're already not expanding it in the states, and then you cut it federally, that means less funding to actually help those in greatest need. So it doesn't really make much sense. If the intent is to help those in greatest need, why would you cut funding there? Number two, the people that are choosing to opt out can be a whole host of reasons, one of which are young people who may believe, you know what, I'm healthy enough. I feel like because there's that sense of defensibility, and for people that are opting out because they can be on their spouse's plans because their plans may have equal or greater coverage. So the reality is that, plus of the reason, 20 million people versus more than 300 million people, we should not be taking away health care. We should be creating more opportunity for them.
Let's be very clear. I read the bill, and I'm kind of confused, so I'm going to ask you. In Ohio, where we sit, pre-existing conditions. Now, when if Obamacare gets repealed, which this bill does, is it left up to the states? Do we still have pre-existing conditions? What happens with that?
Well, there's two pieces to the question around pre-existing conditions. It would seem, from what we've seen from the proposals in the House and in the Senate, that pre-existing conditions potentially would be covered. However, some portions, such as prenatal care for women, would be seen as a pre-existing condition that would not be covered. And so, you know, one's gender should never be a reason to be determined as a pre-existing condition. That's absolutely reprehensible. It is wrong. It's unacceptable. That is not a proposal we should be supporting at all. Second, let's be clear. The reason why you have insurers that have not been in the state plans and pulling out of the plans is because the states chose to, 19 of them, predominantly ones who are Republican governors, to not expand Medicaid. So when you have that happen, what then happens? You have less competition in the states, which leads to rising costs. So, number one, if you want to bring down the cost, then find more ways to have expansion in the states so we can have more competition in the states, which is exactly what the intent of the Affordable Care Act. And number two, never, ever should there be a scenario where someone's pre-existing condition is seen as a negative against them. We should always be covering pre-existing conditions. The Republican plan in the House and the Senate does not do that. That's the reason why we have to reject the repeal.
Okay, if I'm in Ohio and this does pass, and I have diabetes or I have cancer, what happens?
Well, look, you know, depending on the final language, which we don't know what the final language is, if you can have a scenario where a company, an insurer provider, determines that those are seen as pre-existing conditions and therefore does not cover you. So, again, we could be in a scenario where only the younger communities and those that are already the most healthy are being covered. That's exactly the wrong approach we should be going down. So for the people of Ohio, what we're saying to you very clearly, you have to make sure you're calling out to your senators, saying very clearly to Senator Thurman especially, we cannot have a repeal of the Affordable Care Act. We should be working together to make it better rather than taking it away. Call this phone number, 202-224-3121. 202-224-3121. I say you can call Senator Portman and other senators to demand. You do not want to see this taken away. And very clearly, Scott, here's the question. Ask them, what actually is good about the bill? Why are you in support of this bill? When everything is indicating that 22 million people will lose their health care coverage, why on earth would we be doing this at all? This is a tax cut for the wealthy. It is not providing help to those that need help on the ground. We have to be focused on providing opportunity for everyone, not for the top 1%. And so, if you have cancer and you have other illnesses such as that, if you have a pre-existing condition, the passage of the proposal that is coming forward from the Senate Republicans and the Congressional Republicans as a whole would make it harder for you to be covered, which, quite frankly, if you don't have coverage and you have greater expenses, it becomes harder on you in your lives. This bill will not help you. That's why it must be rejected.
There's a big problem in Ohio. I'm sure you know study that came out last week says Ohio has more opiate overdose deaths than any other state. Okay, if this bill goes through, what happens to those people?
The funding is going to be cut. That's one of the critical pieces. In addition to the cuts towards Medicaid, there's a substantial cut towards opioid treatment and the additions and concerns around those that are addicted to opioid drugs and others. So, again, just helps us to practically understand this. Why would we have a bill? Why would they support a bill? Why would the Senate Republicans and House Republicans put forth a bill that would specifically cut funding for those in greatest need, cut funding to address opioid addictions, cut funding and support to make sure pre-existing conditions are covered, cut funding that would help women and young people and seniors? It doesn't make sense. Clearly and simply, look, that's the reason why, Scott, you look at all the polling and all the different aspects. Even the Fox News poll, the highest it said was a 27% support for the repeal. Everywhere else you're seeing it's anywhere between 12% to 16%. People do not support this. So, for the people of Ohio, whether you live in Appalachia, whether you're in Cleveland, Columbus, Cincinnati, or Dayton, Youngstown, Akron, wherever it may be, no matter where you're at in the state, no matter where you're at in the state of Ohio, the repeal of the Affordable Care Act without any real alternative is something that must be rejected. And let's be clear, the reason why we're seeing the proposals right now are simply it would hurt communities, and we cannot see that move forward in any way.
One of my final questions is truthfully, as Democrats, the Democratic senators cannot stop it. If every one of them vote against it, they can't stop it. If all the Republicans vote for it, what is it like to be a Democrat right now?
Well, look, I mean, this is a reason why elections matter, and us need to be very clear about that. And so when we think about what's at stake, that's the reason why you now have 9 Republican senators that said they cannot vote for this bill. But this is when we go back to what Senator Schumer said today. Let's work together in a bipartisan manner to find resolutions. You know, we cannot be in a scenario where this is about party. This is not about a party. This is about the country. This is about people. You know, when you go into a doctor's office, you're not asking if they're Republican, Democrat, or independent. You just want help. When you talk to your school teacher, you just want help. You just want to know that someone's going to help you and fight for you. That's what we should be focusing on. And then at the end of the day, if individuals are willing to take a vote, which we've seen now on the House side, let's see if the Senate side, if they're willing to take a vote, let's see here.
Two more questions real quick. Why can't we work as a country? Why is everything so partisan? Oh, I think we're losing you there. Are you still there? I think if you can still hear me, call back the number you called, because we lost the connection there. Hopefully we'll get DNC Vice Chair Michael Blake back on the line. But it's an interesting thing. Some people are in support of this health care plan. Some people are not in support. We had somebody call in late yesterday who was in support. I don't know. I guess you fall where you fall, and you choose to do what you choose to do. And I guess as the DNC vice chair said there, that elections do matter, and it is important to do what you need to do. And I think we now have Vice Chair Michael Blake back on the line.
It seems like the phone carrier wanted to be partisan right there.
The question was, why can't we come together as a country? Why does this keep happening time after time?
It shouldn't. You know, look, elections, obviously, you know, rhetoric can get heightened, and we have different visions of where we want to take the country, and we recognize that. However, this is one of those issues where we should certainly be coming together to figure out a solution here. But let's be clear. Here's what's at stake, Scott, and to everyone that's listening. There are more than 5 million people in Ohio with pre-existing conditions, 635,700 people added to Medicaid due to the expansion, 47.2% reduction in the insurance rate because of the Affordable Care Act. This should not be a partisan issue on either side. This should be, let's figure out a way to come together. Now, look, elections happen. We recognize that's part of the reason why we all have different rhetoric that we talk through. But at the end of the day, we are here to help people. We are here to fight for the people. And what we talk about in the Democratic Party, a clear message of how we create economic opportunity and opportunity for all. How are we fighting for everyone, fighting for you, not just fighting for the top 1%. But at the end of the day, this is not about partisan issues. This should not be about party. This must be about the people. The people need health care. They do not need campaign slogans. They do not need it repealed.
Final question, because I know we're on limited time here. They've postponed the vote, but they want to vote on it. If you were a betting man, do you think it'll pass?
At this current juncture, I would say no. But the reality is this, you can't let up. You know, you saw what happened on the House side when they tried to move forward the first time, and then they didn't have the votes that came back around. And now 217 congressional members will forever have it on their record. They try to take the health care away. So now on the Senate side, Mitch McConnell has said he's going to try to do everything they can to try to find the votes to take away health care. Not that they're trying to find ways to make improvements, not the ways they were trying to make actual adjustments here. So we prepare for a bill to come forward again. That's the reason, again, we encourage everyone, call this number, 202-224-3121, 202-224-3121. Make your voices heard. We cannot have a repeal happen. It is too much at stake right now.
DNC Vice Chair Michael Blake, thank you so much.
Thank you, Scott. Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye. Very interesting stuff. I'm glad we got him back to get those last two questions in. Before we talk with Emil Dansker here, if you have any questions that you would like to weigh in on the Tony Campolo interview from earlier on, or what DNC Vike had to say there, give me a call, 740-389-9944. Certainly would love to hear from you. 740-383-9944. The topic there was healthcare, and again, we do want to thank DNC Vice Chairman Michael Blake for coming on. And again, any Republican who would like to come on, I believe we're going to have Jim Jordan next week. We've almost got that confirmed. So we will keep the conversation going here on WWGH Radio, because that's what we need to do. We've got to continue the conversation. For good, for bad, Republican, Democrat, we're all Americans, and hopefully we come to the best solution for America. And I thought Dr. Campolo said it very well earlier on, that let's stop demonizing Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, and let's be people. Let's be Americans. I've said that, tried to say that in so many ways, that, you know, these are people. These are not aliens. So, you know, that's the way it goes. But again, you're tuned into WWGH Radio, and we thank the guests we've had on today, Dr. Tony Campolo, the former spiritual advisor to President Bill Clinton during the Monica Lewinsky scandal, and we thank DNC Vice Chairman Michael Blake for coming on early this hour to discuss healthcare in America. Now we're going to switch. Instead of talking about healthcare, we're going to talk about journalism. And we're going to talk about journalism with a guest I've had on several times. So glad he's able to join us via telephone again. He is an award-winning journalist, an award-winning professor of journalism from Southern Ohio. So glad to welcome back to these microphones, Emil Dansker. Emil, how are you?
Well, I'm well, thank you.
So good to speak with you. Let's just get right into it. The press and Donald Trump's presidency. We have not talked since President Trump took office. What do you make of the relationship there?
Well, you know, it's been said, it was said years ago, that you never pick an argument with a guy who buys ink by the barrel. That is the ink that went into printing presses. But that doesn't seem to bother the president and his people these days. And perhaps with the new technology, it's not really new anymore, it's a whole different situation anyway. But it's a problem. It's a concern. And we in the Society of Professional Journalists are quite concerned about it.
When you hear the term that Donald Trump has coined, fake news, what do you think?
Well, I think he's off base. I think he's just coming up with something, and he grabbed it and he ran with it, and there are people out there who believe in it. You know, it used to be said, you don't believe anything you read in the newspaper, and that was almost a joke. But today, we do make mistakes. Over the years, I've made very few mistakes. A couple I made were big ones, but we do the best we can. Our whole emphasis is accuracy. I used to have, in my office, I had a little airplane towing a banner that said accuracy. And I drummed that into all of my students, and they've done pretty well with it.
You know, Emil, it's interesting because we have people at the station that I talk to off the air, and we have people who call in on the air. And this is the thing I keep hearing, some form of this. Forget Russia, forget these investigations, the media is out to get Trump, leave him alone to do the job we elected him to do. To that, you say what?
Well, I think that's probably not a bad way to put it. We have to continue doing our job. We can't quit, as it were, there are people on the other side, I would say the other side, who don't understand the mission, or who don't want to understand it, we just have to do the best we can. My whole emphasis to my students was get it right, do whatever it takes to get it right.
But the American people don't believe the press anymore. I think it's in the 20 percentile. They, because of what's going on, they just don't trust them.
Well, there is that, but I'm not sure whether that really is quite that accurate itself. That we have a lot of people who just already to believe what they believe. They like what they like, and when they hear something they like, they accept it. And we just have to keep being as accurate as we can be, because I always said to my students, if we're not accurate, we're not anything.
What is the mission of a journalist who is covering the White House today, in your opinion?
Say again, please.
What is the mission of a journalist who is covering the White House today, in your opinion?
Well, to get the news and to put it out to the people. The readers, the listeners out there, I have at least a couple of former students who are covering the White House, and that has been their mission, and they keep going.
Is it tough, though? Is it tough when it seems to be a war between the president and the press?
Well, yes, in a way it does. I think the president is... does not have a I'm not sure if it's that he doesn't have an understanding or he doesn't want to have an understanding. I don't know that I want to say he doesn't care, but I'm not sure he knows what he cares. I'm not sure he understands the role of the press. After all, again, it was Thomas Jefferson who said that if he had to give a choice with or without newspapers, he would pick newspapers. And of course, we have one of the concerns we have now is social media, where so many people so often, day after day, time after time, will come up with something, and they have an avenue for it, they have an outlet for it, and they keep it going, and it's tough when something happens to in a sense to deal with it.
When we talk about Watergate, you were around working in journalism during the days of Watergate. What is your comparison to this Russia story versus Watergate?
Well, that's again that's kind of hard to say with in a way that we didn't have so we had one source for Watergate who came out many years later, but. Again, we had a story, and we had a couple of guys who were able to run with it, and we had an editor and a publisher who were willing to support them, and they kept going until they got the story. And of course, we also had a president who perhaps didn't entirely understand either, and advisors just as now who don't entirely understand it, and they kept. Making mistakes. Thought they were covering, but they were making mistakes.
In your opinion, as a journalist, do you think there's anything to this Russia story and collusion?
Well, I think there is, but it's hard to say how much of it was there, how much of it was responsible for the problem, and I think. There is too much there to say that there isn't anything there, but perhaps it's going to take Mueller's investigation to really bring it out.
If you were advising someone today on where to get good, truthful news, what would you tell them to look at or read?
Well, I would tell them to read the Christian Science Monitor. In fact, for many years I've been a reader of the Monitor, and I've said that if there had to be only one publication, it ought to be the Monitor. The Monitor, while it's published by the Christian Science Publishing Society, has only one small essay every issue on science itself. And what they do is they have I wish I had a copy of it right in front of me, where Mary Baker Eddy, Eddy, who established it in the years before the First World War, said our job is to find out what's going on and get it right. And many of the best journalists over the years have done that. And I think if one I read the New York Times every day. For example, I have page one in my hand as we speak here. But I'm surprised, by the way, at the number of corrections that the Times runs every day. They seem to be making mistakes that they ought not to be making. But if we go back to that other idea, I happen to like CNN. I happen to surf the various stations, magazines. But I would go back again to the idea that somehow or other the monitor, over its many, many years, has managed to do a job of getting the material, emphasizing getting it right, and I think and always looking for the positive side of something. If there's a problem, they try to dig for and report the answer, or at least what appears to be an answer, and that's pretty good too.
I haven't read that publication for a while. How have they treated the last election and the Trump presidency?
Well, I would say straight away, they are people who as I've indicated, go after the truth, and they do an excellent job of looking for it and presenting it, and that's perhaps all we could do in this business. Call it a business.
I want you to give me a thumbnail sketch. Not that you covered them directly, but I want to go back to, let's start with Roosevelt, which is probably maybe the first president you have a memory of.
Indeed.
Let's start there, and you tell me, give me a thumbnail sketch of these people and their relationship with the press, and let's start with Franklin Roosevelt.
Well, we could even go back to William Howard Taft, who was the first really to have a specific relationship with the press. Actually, he'd been a reporter in his younger days, but in Roosevelt's days, well, again, we had a lot of very experienced people there, some of whom I knew, and again, it's a matter of looking at what's there. And doing the best job you can to find out what's going on and to report it.
But tell me how you think Roosevelt handled the press. Do you think he liked them? Do you think he did it well? Do you think he was covered truthfully?
Oh, I think he did it well. I was just reading a book. As a matter of fact, there's a book called Commander in Chief, which happens to be about actually specifically 1943. It talks about his ability he had a feeling for the press, he knew what he could say and what he chose to say and what he chose not to say. But there were some very experienced people back in those days who'd covered the presidents for many, many years. And they were able to take what was said and deal with it.
Tell me about what you think of Harry Truman in the press.
Well, Truman was another one, and he did a pretty good job with the press. But also, perhaps we should have said in those days we didn't have the social media that we have now. We didn't have everything grabbing everything and running with it. I think actually Truman did a pretty good job. I never met him, but I knew people who covered him, I think he had a feel for what he could say and how he could say it, I think he did a good job.
The first president covered on television, Dwight Eisenhower.
Uh-huh.
What do you think was he good with the press?
Well, yeah, I think a lot of what we're sort of dealing with here is this question of social media, where it wasn't just a matter of in fact, in those days of three major networks, certain newspapers with reputation, but boy, I hear somebody trying to call me. What that sound is. Well, the biggest change probably is social media. That newspaper is going down. Newspapers are cutting back or going out of business, and they're trying to reach a wider market. It's a whole different media world now.
In your lifetime, who do you think handled the press the best, president-wise?
In my time?
Yes.
Well, let's see. I would say probably Roosevelt.
A lot of people thought Kennedy did. Do you think he was good with the press?
Well, he was. That's right. He was pretty good. He'd also been done writing himself, and he had friends in the press, of course. And I knew some of those people, but I would think that the people we've talked about, probably Roosevelt, had the best feel for it.
Who handled it the worst?
The worst?
Yeah, the worst.
Well, I think what we're going through now is the worst. I don't think George W. Bush did such a great job, but it's what's going on now where we've got, again, a lot of it has to do with social media, with the rise of social media and the number of outlets, it's a whole new world. I'll say that again.
Well, how do we deal with social media? It's not going to go away, and a lot of it is not the truth. How do you deal with it?
Well, you just have to take it. You know, it's not like the guy who buys ink by the barrel. You have all these people out here putting out things, and they can say what they want, when, and almost how they want it. And we just have to deal with the multiplicity of sources and the multiplicity of outlets that are out there for us, that are telling us things. And who do you believe? Well, no easy answer to that. You believe the guy who's never made a mistake, or who makes few mistakes. That's one way you determine who to believe.
Will newspapers survive the internet boom?
Well, I think they're going to survive, but it's already very different, and it's going to be very different. Yesterday, the latest issue of the magazine that's put out by the Medill School of Journalism in Northwestern, where I was graduated, and they have what they call integrated media, and they're trying to consider the whole picture, including the business side, and they're trying to teach people again take a very broad view of what's going on in the world. They have a lot of foreign activity now. They have programs in the East and the West, and they have a school in Gutter, and they're doing everything they can in order to find out. Again, it's almost as simple as saying to find out what's going on and to make every effort to get it right.
As a professor, when you want to get it right, if you're teaching a student, how do you sit down, write a story that may be negative to President Trump? I think any story on Russia he would take as negative, but don't show any bias. How do you write a negative story about somebody, but don't show your bias?
Well, it depends on whether you're writing a straight news or whether you're writing opinion. If you're writing opinion, and I have in my hand here the of the New York Times, where you're saying opinion, and you do not apologize for it. You have a column in which you express your opinion, if I suppose one could call it bias, and you work at it. You admit that you're giving opinion as opposed to reporting the facts as best you can come up with them. And once again, you do the best job you can.
You know, it's interesting. I want to read this story because it has to do with the New York Times and the editorial page. Former vice presidential nominee and Alaska Governor Sarah Palin is accusing the New York Times of defamation over an editorial that linked one of her political action committee ads to the mass shooting that severely wounded then-Arizona Congresswoman Gabby Giffords. In the lawsuit filed in Manhattan's federal court Tuesday, Palin's lawyers said the Times violated the law and its own policies when it accused her of inciting the 2011 attack that killed six people. The lawsuit refers to a June editorial in the Times on the recent shooting of Louisiana Congressman Steve Scalise. The editorial was later corrected. Palin is seeking damages to be determined by a jury. A spokeswoman for the New York Times, Danielle Rhodes, says they haven't seen the lawsuit but will defend against any claim vigorously. Now, I'm confused, Emil. How can an editorial have a correction, is it? Correction. Isn't an editorial an opinion?
Well, basically it is, yes. And, of course, one can differ with the opinion. I've read that, but it's been a few days now.
Again, we're chatting with Emil Dansker, who is
okay. Somebody's trying to get this line.
Okay, go ahead, Emil. We didn't hear what you said about the article there.
What about the Palin piece?
Yes,
we're talking about. Well, she has her opinion, and I read the piece. It seems to me that it's straight away. They express an opinion, and she doesn't like it. And if she doesn't like it, she can go to court, which she did.
Do you think she will win the case?
No, but not being an attorney, I have two daughters who are attorneys, but. No, I don't think she's gonna win, but she has every right to pursue her case.
Do you think people are more thin-skinned? Politicians, public people, are more thin-skinned today than they used to be?
No, I don't think so. It may seem that way because there's more media to put it out there. But one can go back into a couple hundred years of our history and see the things that were said by and for politicians. In a way, things were a lot more bitter back perhaps in the earlier 19th century, but it's there was I remember the case of an editor who was horsewhipped by a guy who didn't like something he wrote. And other people have gone into editors' offices and tried to clobber them over these years. It's been a tough situation to deal with.
In the last few minutes here, in the long journalism career you had, what was the biggest mistake you made, and how did you handle it?
Well, let's see. I just had occasion to refer to this earlier this week. I'm not sure. Was this the biggest one? Was it an incident when I was in Dayton? It was a story that had to do with the amount that was a community chest thing, the fund drive, and the fund drive had three parts to it, and when I wrote the story, I added the figures wrong, and the story said that the fund, I think, was $300,000 more than it actually was, and we had to, of course, run a correction of that. It was a mistake. It was a simple mistake in the sense that I made the mistake because I added the figures wrong, but I had called the public relations guy for the organization to confirm those figures, and he told me that I wasn't supposed to have them, and he wasn't going to confirm them. He wasn't going to say anything. That was my problem, he said. Well, I called him later, and I said, "Don't you think that was kind of peevish that you had an opportunity to correct the figures, and you look worse than we did because of the mistake in the total?" And he said, "No, no, no. That was your problem." Well, in one sense, it was my problem, but I made the mistake. But it could have been handled a little bit differently from the other end.
You know, that's an interesting part of journalism. If the person involved doesn't confirm it, and 9 times out of 10 they don't, if it's a breaking story, they don't speak to you. How do you run with the story if you can't talk to the person directly involved, but you know people who are making the accusation? The accusers usually will talk.
Well, you'd report what you're getting and how you're getting it, and you do the best you can with that. It partly depends on how important a story it is, whether you need to run with it, say, at a particular time. But like, for example, trusting your sources. How do you decide? I did a paper once on how do we decide who to believe. I said that one of the basic ways is that you get information from somebody who has never lied to you before. He's given you information that has where he's not lied to you, and that's probably the best way to trust a source.
If you had to put one story of your career in a time capsule that it's going to be opened 500 years from now, what would you put in there?
What story would that be?
Yeah, what's the greatest story you think you ever covered? What was the best time?
Oh my goodness, I'd really have to stop and think about that, because I had a great career, and I really regret any of it, and I'd almost have to think a little bit about that. Which was the best one? I've got things running through my mind, but I'm not coming up with one.
Who was the greatest person you ever met, for your own personal opinion? Who
did
you
met?
Yeah. During your career, who was your favorite person that maybe you got to interview or got to meet? Yeah. Who?
There goes that terrible sound again that indicates that somebody's trying to call me.
Greatest person you ever met.
Greatest person I ever met? Oh, my goodness. Wow. That might be a tough one, too.
Well, were there any presidents?
Quit trying to call, but
I know.
That's another story.
We only got about 3 minutes left here, but is there somebody you met that you really did not like? Is there somebody who just we would know, maybe long since gone, who you really did not enjoy meeting?
They're wasting a lot of your time.
Well, that's it. Is there anybody you met that you did not enjoy?
That I didn't enjoy.
Yeah, that maybe a famous person, a president that you found maybe odd, different. I hope this isn't the fire department trying to call, or the police department. They are desperate to get a hold of you, that's for sure. Oh, well. Well, we'll keep working with it here. 56, coming up on 57 minutes past the hour. Chatting with Emil Dansker, you know, I think we're going to let those people get a hold of him. So if you have an opinion, we certainly thank Emil for coming on. Telephone number 740-383-9944. We do have some time left in the program, so if you'd like to call in, please do. 740-383-9944. What do you think of what Emil Dansker had to say? DNC Vice Chairman Michael Blake or Tony Cam... Oh, my goodness. My mind's going. Tony Campolo in the first hour. What do you think? Any opinions? You have 3 minutes to go here. 740-383-9944. That's 740-383-9944. Remember, Marion Midget Football celebrating 45 years of football and cheerleading. The 2017 registration is at Lincoln Park, 5:30 to 7 p.m. tonight, June the 29th. Tackle football and cheerleading, ages 8 to 12 years old. A one-time $30 fee is required, and a birth certificate. King and Queen signups will be for $10. That's the fee for all ages. For more information, contact 740-382-4558 or 740-751-2948. And again, Marion Midget Football starts the first weekend after Labor Day. Okay, we've got Emil back. Emil, somebody you covered who you didn't like.
Well, I'm not so much that I didn't like him, but I was thinking one story about Eddie Rickenbacker. He was my hero, my idol. You know, the American ace of World War One. And there was a particular picture of him with his foot on the wheel of a Spad, the French fighter plane that he flew in World War One. And so I had occasion to interview him back in the days when I was a report aviation writer for the Enquirer. Every time an aviation person came to town, they would send me out to cover the story. By that time, Rickenbacker, who had already survived three crashes that should have killed anybody else, was retired, and he sold Eastern Airlines, and he was flying, touring the country, making talks, and he was. He had a certain bias, and I thought he was just almost a senile old man, and I was sorry I'd met him after all those years. Well, years later, I was at Dayton at the Air Force Museum where they took in members of the Aviation Hall of Fame, and he was taken in. And I'm sitting there across from him, he's sitting there, I'm sitting there, Jimmy Stewart was presenting him, and on a rear screen projector came a picture of Rickenbacker with his foot on the wheel of the Spad, and it came back. He was my hero again.
I love it. What was his bias?
Say again?
What was his bias? You say he had a bias. What was his bias?
Well, he was right wing, I was conservative.
Is the media liberal with 10 seconds left to go?
Oh, I don't think we can say that, that the media is liberal. The media does its job, and we just have to, I think, take it for what it is.
Emil Dansker, legendary journalist here in Ohio and journalism professor. Emil, we'll have to get you back now that I have your email. Stay in touch, and it's always a pleasure.
And we'll see who was trying to call me.
And okay, we'll find. Hopefully it's not the fire department. It might be Rickenbacker from the grave. You never know. Thank you, Emil.
Bye.
Emil Dansker, we're done for this day. This is Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
Made Pat Carroll.
Well, what we do without gossip, for heaven's sake, Scott. Oh, it's naughty, but it certainly fulfills a certain caddy sense.